the level of state repression is incredibly high, and the risks that people are taking to engage in this kind of revolutionary activity is incredibly high. It's not Instagram posts. It's not even threatening losing your job. It's threatening to lose your head, right? If you speak out against the system.
Hi, I'm Tobias Haberkorn. You're listening to Airlift from Berlin Review. For half a century, a mass movement of Eastern European Jews had a radical answer to the persecution they faced. Instead of leaving their countries, they argued for staying and trying to make life better for Jews and other marginalized groups. The movement was the Jewish Labour Bund, a secular, socialist Jewish political party founded in the Russian Empire in 1897. While many of the stories of the Bund were erased during the war in the Shoah, and then again in post-war communist Russia, two new books are bringing the Bund's history back into conversation. One is Molly Krabappel's Here Where We Live Is Our Country, and the other, by Donny Gluckstein and Janie Stone, is called The Radical Jewish Tradition. Today's guest reviewed both books for Berlin Review. Faith Hillis is a historian of the late Russian Empire at the University of Chicago. She's a recent Guggenheim Fellow and the author of Utopia's Discontents. She joined my colleague Hannah Sabot to discuss the history of the Bund, the challenges of her archival research, and the risks of drawing analogies between present anti-Zionist movements and those from the past. Here is their conversation.
So, Faith, how did you first come across the Bund, and why do you think more people aren't aware of it and its history?
To be quite honest, I don't remember the first time I came across the Bund. I think I probably saw it mentioned in general histories of the Russian Revolution. I began learning about it in earnest when I was writing Utopia's Discontents, which is a book about the Russian radical diaspora. And one of the shocking discoveries I made in that book was that, well, A, how fascinating Bundism is, and B, the huge role that it played in just creating Russian radical culture in general. So what I discovered was that a huge portion of this Russian radical diaspora in the late 19th, early 20th century was actually Jewish and was explicitly Bundist. And a lot of what the book ended up being about was about how when working class Russian Jews went into immigration, many of them were just fleeing pogroms or fleeing economic crisis, no particular political interest, how many of them became radicalized overseas. And so I began working with Bundist sources in earnest and really getting into the archives and the memoirs and realizing that this party had actually really fascinating contemporary, and I should say, when I say contemporary, this was already like 10 to 15 years ago, I was discovering the Bund, as it were. But then it had fascinating contemporary overtones in the sense that it was propagating a kind of intersectional politics that revolved around Jewish identity, but was also universalist and interested in connecting with other minority groups. And again, like I said, just was really, really important in the Russian Revolution and the Russian sort of radical imagination. In terms of why it has eluded attention, I think it has eluded attention both for academics and for the general public. So I think for academics, there's a pretty sharp divide, actually, in the concerns of academic Jewish history, Jewish studies, and Russian or Slavic or East European studies. So those two topics are not really viewed in tandem very often, and we tend to ask our own questions. So it tends to be the Russianists who are interested in the questions of revolution and revolutionary parties, and they tend not to read Yiddish, so they just don't look at the Bund, aren't interested in the Bund, right, and don't access it. There's also, I think, very obvious political reasons why the Bund has eluded interest. So this is discussed in detail in the two books I reviewed, but that the Bund and sort of anti-Zionist Jewish radicalism is not a force that has been hailed in sort of mainstream Jewish life, Jewish history, and to some extent has actually been actively repressed in the memory of how people write 20th century, 19th century history. So I think it's the conjunction of just discovering this totally fascinating party with that's dealing with really contemporary issues. And then this political question of why it's been overlooked in the context of growing disenchantment with Israel, campaigns against Gaza, so on and so forth, and Jews in America, but also around the world, looking for new ways of being Jewish, connecting to their Jewish identity and connecting to the Jewish past. And I think that this explains why this topic that's been sort of silenced, forgotten for so long is now coming into the mainstream in full force.
You yourself are an accomplished historian, and your 2021 book, Utopia's Discontents, was focused on Russian emigre communities, many of whom were also carrying radical thought and were operating in exile or in kind of emigre colonies across Europe in the 19th and early 20th century. I know you touch on the Bund in that book as well, but I wanted to ask, as someone who has yourself dealt with, let's say, esoteric or scattered materials and materials relating to, particularly to the kind of intellectual and historical traditions of radical or anti-establishment groups, what do you see as the challenges of telling these sorts of histories?
Yeah. Writing on groups like the Bund is incredibly difficult. In addition to the linguistic challenges I already mentioned, there's the fact that the sources are just incredibly scattered, and it takes a really long time to locate them, to put them together, to read them. They're scattered because there was never a state entity or an entity with power, essentially, that was interested in cataloging the history of the Bund or radical movements like this, right? Normally, archives are created by states or by organizations, and a historian interested in a question just has to walk into the archive and find the relevant archival collection to read and mine. And when you're working on radical history, there is nothing like that. There are scattered emigre archives that are honestly quite incredible. As people move around and evade the police, some people still manage to take incredible collections. But by definition, they are piecemeal. And they're fragmentary. And so it can be difficult to narrate a story because you may find, you know, one thread about this one topic in a particular emigre archive, and you're sort of trying to follow the thread, and there's nowhere else you can take it. So I guess how I would describe the experience of working with these emigre and radical archives is that they're often gems, but just incredibly scattered. And so the question of how you create a narrative is a challenging one. The tactic that I've used, and it's a tactic that Crabapple uses as well, is to focus on people and personalities and to tell the stories of people as they move. And I should also say many of the figures in her book and in radical history in general are in constant movement. And that's another thing that makes the sources scattered, right? First, they're in Vilna, then they move to London, and then they move to Paris, and then they move to New York, and then they come back and they leave little bits and traces as they go. But that can be a good way of tying together a very complex narrative by focusing on the characters that you find. Another really excellent source in writing radical history, although it has its own drawbacks, is memoirs. So many Bundists left behind really, really vivid memoirs that actually give us a better sense, in many cases, than archives can, of just what was going on, what their experience was. Again, historians tend to approach memoirs with skepticism, as they're obviously written through an individual point of view, right, and with a particular agenda in mind. But I think that that can also be an incredibly rich source, and it is one that that Crabapple mines in her book.
I know that in Crabapple's book, there's a lot of these little kind of vignettes that she uses, many of which are drawing on memoirs. And Crabapple's book is also, as you've described, drawing from her own experiences, her own organizing work. And I think that gives, as you described in the review, a particular focus on the sometimes quite petty and quite interpersonal differences and fights that were going on. And I guess maybe you would want to say a little bit more about what memoir can do to trace those more interpersonal or idiosyncratic aspects of movement history or radical history.
Yeah, I think the memoirs can be interesting, first of all, because they are from such a personal vantage point. And so just thinking about the kinds of things that people focus on, I'll give you one example that immediately sprang to mind. It's a little far afield from the Bund, but there's a connection. So it was about Yuli Martov, who became a leading Menshevik theorist and party leader in the Russian Revolution, actually, who in the 1890s was very connected with the Bund and was kind of a proto-Bundist before he became a Menshevik. But it was a story about his break with Lenin during the Russian Revolution. And it was this memoir that was just so searingly personal. Sometimes these pieces will almost bring you to tears reading them. It was someone who had known both Lenin and Martov for years and was really dealing with the fallout of their intellectual and personal breakup, as it were. But this person was describing how they were in a fight at this party conference, and Martov had developed a terrible case of tuberculosis in living in these emigre hovels. And as he was getting more agitated, he was coughing and, you know, spewing and very upset. And the Bolsheviks and Lenin were yelling at him and sort of pulling on his coat and showing his physical weakness. And it was just the way that this was described. It was almost like you were there witnessing the really dramatic and tragic fallout between these two men. So there's that element. There's also the interesting element of being able to see things from different perspectives. So one of the things that people critique in memoirs is that they're too personalized, right? The point of view is from one person and you don't know that it's reliable. But you'll often see events are witnessed by multiple people and are written about by multiple people. And you see the ways that their accounts are different. But this can also kind of allow you to triangulate based on what you know. You know, is this reliable? Is that reliable? Or sometimes focus on actually the different ways that people experience a similar event. So yeah, it can just be an incredibly rich source. I also have to say, in reading all these different radical memoirs, you can get just a sense of the personality of the person, who they are in the world, how they operate. And again, I think that's something Krabappel brings out very well. But in reading these memoirs, I sensed that the different radical parties attracted people with different psychological constitutions and different makeups. And you had a sense not only of who the person was as an individual actor, but sort of what drew them to the party. And I have to say that the Bundists always had the most interesting, most lively memoirs. You know, you have the sense that, like, of all the radicals, if you get invited to a party, as it were, you want to go to the Bundist party, right? They're just, the way they narrate their experience is, despite their individual differences, can be quite particular and just give me a really different sense of, wow, the Bund operated in a really different way than, say, for example, the Bolsheviks, who wrote the driest and most boring memoirs. The most colorful Bundist memoir that I can think of is written by a man named Vladimir Medim, who is an interesting character because he had been raised in a family that was Jewish by heritage, but they had converted to Lutheranism, basically to get along. It was just easier to be a Lutheran in Tsarist Russia. And so Medim grew up not knowing much about Judaism and not knowing any Yiddish, which was quite typical as well of many Bundists, that Russian or Polish, which was the language of the assimilated, successful Jewish majority, would be the language they would be raised in, and they would have to learn Yiddish as a second language. So Medim provides really interesting vignettes about sort of what Judaism means to him as he's discovering just what this thing is. So one of the things he talks about is that his family had lost basically all Jewish customs, but he knew that lighting Shabbat candles was a thing. And so he describes very viscerally the way he feels when he sees candles in people's windows, right? That it makes him feel at home, or like, this person's connected to me, even if they're not ostensibly connected to him in any way. It's a way of discovering, moving something very deep in himself. He also includes some details in his memoirs that are seemingly irrelevant, but getting back to how we can sort of triangulate what's actually happening in communities. One of the big themes of Krabappel's book is the feminism of the Bund, and that many of these radical movements were, although they were dominated by men, they had feminist agendas because that was seen as a revolutionary way of being in the world. But Medim, kind of despite himself, provides really interesting flashes of the ways that patriarchy and more traditional forms of life still survive within these Bundist communities. So he gives this example of when he's a student in Basel. Basel University was a university that was very popular among Jewish students. So there was a whole Jewish colony in Basel. And he talks about how one of his friends had a relationship with this woman, and then the woman became pregnant, which, although this community was comprised of radical students, was actually still seen as a scandalous thing. This woman's pregnant out of wedlock. What's going to happen? And there's a whole kerfuffle among these Jewish radicals who essentially force the man to marry the woman to be proper. And then it turns out that the woman was never pregnant after all, and it was just basically a ruse to get her boyfriend to marry her, which is just an interesting insight into the ways in which, first of all, there are still traditional mores that are governing this radical community. And second of all, the way that Medem himself describes this woman and like her turmoil, right? You have it from the male part of you, but not from the female part of you. But you sense the way that he himself is still influenced by these kind of patriarchal point of views, that it's the woman doing this, you know, this trick to get this man to marry her. So there are ways, I think, of getting, just flashes of color about the lives of these people, who they are, how their mind works. And then also in the case of this fake pregnancy, sort of how the community works and how it functions, whether or not that accords to the stated values of the community.
And yeah, on this note of maybe the ways that even a revolutionary and emancipatory movement like the Bund still contained patriarchal structures, still, you know, had, you know, actively patriarchal practices. I think that sort of reality check, so to speak, is also quite an interesting part of the book. And I wanted to ask you next, actually, about another place where, alongside all of the ways that the Bund ruptures maybe a teleological Zionist sense of history and also appears or describes itself as a rupture with the history of religious observant Jewish traditional communities in Eastern Europe, if you see also continuities with the way that the Bund operated in relation to earlier religious practices. And particularly, I was struck by one of the points you made in your review about the messianistic aspects of some revolutionary movements and of Jewish revolutionary movements in general. There's a line in Crabapple's book where she describes history as being the new God, and these intentional attempts at flouting Jewish kosher laws in order to kind of show belonging in a new Bundist community. So do you see Bundism as having become a sort of religion for secular Jews at the time, or other ways that there's a continuity?
Yeah, I think both things are true. So on the one hand, Jewish revolutionaries, and not only Bundist, participated in really performative displays of anti-religious disrespect, right? So you mentioned some of them having lascivious balls on Yom Kippur, eating bacon on the steps of synagogues, things like this. At the same time, I think you're absolutely right that there is a messianic strand that runs through revolutionary thought and Jewish revolutionary thought in particular. And I'll give you a couple examples. One of the things that doesn't come up in Crabapple's book is the question of why the Bund originates in Vilna, right? The city now Vilnius in Lithuania. And one of the reasons is that Vilna is a major train depot, and it's the place through which people and books coming in from these radical immigrant colonies in Western Europe and America, everything passes through Vilna as it enters the Russian Empire. And so Vilna gets a lot of the radical literature first. And in fact, one of the circles that's really important in founding the Bund and laying the foundations for the Bund is a rabbinical academy, a rabbinical seminary in Vilna. So you have all of these rabbis in training in Vilna who are going to the train station and getting all this radical literature trucked in from France and Switzerland and reading it. And these guys become Marxists in the 1880s. So we have literal rabbis in training reading Marx and interpreting him as the new prophet. And there's a really fascinating character, doesn't appear in Crabapple's book, does appear in my book, Utopia's Discontents. He's a student at this rabbinical academy. His name is Aaron Lieberman. And he is actually the first Russian to organize a Yiddish-speaking workers' union and to begin to use Yiddish language political agitation. He comes out of this Vilna Rabbinical Academy, and he has an explicitly religious interpretation of revolutionary thought. So he basically says Jews are not only capable of being revolutionaries, they are the revolutionaries par excellence, because the Jewish tradition, in his view, is communistic. He says our prophets are radicals. They practice the sabbatical and the jubilee. They redistribute wealth and land. And this is sort of who we are as Jews. And this strand runs through radical history. There are accounts of revolutionary Haggadahs, for example, that people read at Passover, right, that describe liberation not from Egyptian slavery, but from capitalism. There are examples of sweatshop poets who write keynote, the sort of traditional elegies to read, again, bemoaning here not the destruction of the temple, but the destruction of the capitalist system. And another great example that I'll give you is there's an incredibly influential Yiddish language newspaper that's published in London. It's called Arbeiter Freund. It's actually an anarchist newspaper, but it's widely read across Europe and America and Russia. And its motto is literally the quote of Hillel the Elder, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, who am I?" So there are all these ways in which you see ostensibly atheistic irreligious movements drawing on religious thought, religious prophecy, and yeah, the messianic tradition of sort of the world to come in service of the revolutionary cause.
Those examples are so interesting. I hadn't known about this tradition of the revolutionary Haggadah, but and it's also really interesting to hear that, because to get a little bit towards the second reason of sort of why now and why these popular histories that you were looking at are both being written and also being so widely discussed now is the question of politics and the contemporary. So both books are attempting to draw this lineage across time between a contemporary progressive Jewish movement and these earlier ones. But one key point you make in your essay is that while Bundists were explicitly anti-Zionist from early points, both that there was more interaction between, there was a sort of shared intellectual sphere between Zionists and these other stripes of Jewish thoughts, and perhaps that what it meant to be anti-Zionist at this time, at, you know, starting at the beginning of the 20th century, was different from now. And so I would love to hear first a bit more about what Bundist anti-Zionism actually looked like in this period and uh-huh. leading up to before the Holocaust, uh-huh. and maybe also where there might be limits to this analogy of anti-Zionism now.
Yeah, I think it depends when we're talking about it. I mean, I think Crabapple, actually both books really lean into the Zionist, anti-Zionist dichotomy, which, again, if you're trying to hook a contemporary reader, this makes perfect sense. This is an issue that people are really concerned about right now, and I understand why they would make that choice. But I think that projecting that onto the past, especially the very early history of the Bund, is a little bit problematic. The Bund is never friendly to Zionism, but remember that when the foundations of the Bund are being laid in the 1880s and 90s, Zionism as a political movement is just beginning, right? And so what these movements are and where their boundaries are is somewhat in flux. I would say in the early years of the Bund, the anti-Zionism goes hand in hand with just anti-immigrationist rhetoric. And it's also important to say that far more Jews are immigrating to North America and Europe in this point than are making Aliyah, right? It's a very tiny group of people that are moving to Palestine in the 1880s and 90s. So the doikite of the Bund, yes, it's anti-Zionist, but to say that it's primarily or only anti-Zionist sort of I think misstates the issue. The point is the here-ness, the staying here, the making things better here. And with that goes a kind of federalist mindset. So the Bund is actively drawing on Austro-Marxist thought in the 1890s and 1900s, saying that that the Russian Empire needs to be a safe place for all minority groups, that minority groups also need to have their individual representation that can speak for the needs of their people, and they're working in concert with other groups. I would also say the Bund's anti-Zionism early on is also dominated by the fact that the Bund understands Zionism as a bourgeois movement. Less so, the concerns are less about Palestine per se or about the displacement of the native population. That's not really what the Bund is concerned about. They just see, oh, the Rothschilds are funding this, you know, movement, and the Tsarist regime is also encouraging immigration of Jews, and we need to stay here and fight for a workers' nation, right, where Jews and working class people can be safe. I would say that changes. Krabappel puts the emphasis on when that changes in 1917, talking about the Balfour Declaration. I think the concern about Palestine per se actually develops a bit later. And I would say that happens around 1929, where you have riots and revolts against Jewish settlement in Palestine by the Arab population. And at that point, you do have Bundists saying, you know, we're displacing the native inhabitants. This is wrong. This is a form of colonialism. But it's still actually a very small number of people making that complaint. So I would say that it's primarily the sort of anti-bourgeois orientation of the Bund and its here-ness that dictate the anti-Zionism. It's also worth saying, incidentally, prior to the 1900s, it's not taken for granted that when Jews leave, that the Jewish homeland is in Palestine. I mean, people are talking about Uganda in the 1890s, for example. So there is a little bit in the Krabappel book of projection, right, of the sort of contemporary concern. But it's definitely true that by the 1920s and 30s, the Bund is making forceful critiques of the colonization of Palestine and of its negative impact for both Jews and non-Jews.
And picking up one of the threads that you just mentioned is this question of federalism and of a commitment to a certain solidarity with immediately surrounding populations. You mention in the review that this was a key part of the success of Jewish Bundism, was a declared and put into practice solidarity with other neighbors, whether they were Polish or Russian or other radical working class labor movements. And I wonder if you think that lifting the Bund or other strains of Jewish radical movements from their sort of particular spatial context and their interconnection with other non-Jewish revolutionary movements, and if the act of putting them into a narrative of Jewish radicalism or a sort of historical exploration of the Bund loses or erases something. So are we losing something by reading the Bund in a Jewish tradition rather than in dialogue with other contemporary radical movements?
Right. Yeah. It's another situation of both things being true. So the Bund is proudly Jewish, speaks for the specific problems of the Jewish people and supports Jewish culture, right, in the Yiddish language. But at the same time, it's deeply, deeply influenced by broader intellectual trends in Russia and in Poland, where it emerges. So first and foremost among them is the assimilation of Jews in the Russian Empire that happens in the 1860s. So it's at this point that you begin to see Jews casting off traditional clothes, traditional religious practice, casting off Yiddish for Polish and Russian, which are the languages of high society, and integrating into imperial society. And a byproduct of that is that many of the sons of these assimilationist families become radicals, but they first actually become essentially Russian or Polish radicals. So they are reading literature that is smuggled in from outside. By the 1880s, they're reading Marx, and they're discovering revolutionary ideology. By the 1870s and 80s, tons and tons of the Russian revolutionary movement is supplied by Jews, right? At the same time, though, it's complicated because anti-Semitism remains rife in Russian radical movements. But essentially, you have these radical Jews who are trying to eke out space for themselves within the radical movements. And actually, at the point that the Bund begins, what we have is that circle of Vilna rabbinical students who I mentioned before. They become Marxists and they begin fraternizing with Jewish workers in Vilna. And their initial goal is actually to assimilate Jewish workers. This is what all Russian Jewish radicals have been doing, trying to teach them to speak Russian, to read Marxist tracts in Russian, to act like Russian intelligentsia act. And the workers don't like this. They want to read their Yiddish. And by now we have Yiddish being smuggled in from overseas. We also have the Polish Socialist Party is very, very early in producing Yiddish language agitation. So they're also reading that stuff. And the workers also want more control. They don't want to be told by intellectuals what to do. So there's a kind of struggle between the radical Russified intellectuals and the workers themselves that happens in the 1880s and 90s. And finally, by about 1893-94, the workers win. And the Jewish radicals in Vilna began to publish agitational tracts in Yiddish. And then finally, in 1895, Arkady Kramer, who's one of these intellectuals, writes a sort of ideological statement of the Bund called On Agitation, which says precisely that this movement in Vilna will be organized around the workers. It will be organized around the Yiddish language, the language of popular discourse, and that it will not be focused on small conspiratorial organizations. Rather, it will be focused on the workers and their demands. And this is kind of the moment where the Bund begins taking off and it's formally incorporated in 1897. So yeah, I think thinking of the Bund sort of only as a Jewish movement actually misses part of the story. And it's actually this cross-fertilization with Russian and Polish radical currents. Although the personnel involved are all Jews, I think it's this that actually supplies the Bund with its keen understanding of the problem of minority rights and also of its keen understanding of the necessity of solidarity, that these groups, these minority groups that are all suffering under Tsarist rule and all suffering under capitalism, that they need to cooperate and work together, not against each other.
And I think I'll bring us now to the question of really what this is to bring this history, a history that, as you've described, is perhaps more complicated than any one narrative could describe, one that is interconnected with broader currents of revolutionary thought, of imperial history, but also one that has been at times intentionally suppressed and at the very least sort of neglected by what we might call mainstream narratives of Jewish history. And so I wanted to ask a couple of questions on that note. I guess, first of all, on this question of drawing historical analogies, one of the things that you mentioned compelled you to think more with these texts was that very action. And you describe in your essay for Berlin Review how some of the solidarity practices espoused by the Bund were a sort of what we might call a precursor to late 20th century concepts like intersectionality. I'm wondering how you find these sorts of analogy making to be helpful when teaching or describing this vastly different intellectual and social situation to students and people of today, and kind of what the stakes of that are.
Yeah, a lot of academic historians are very hostile to the idea of presentism and believe that it distorts historical analysis. I think I'm more sympathetic to the idea that our interests in about the past, our interest in the past may be driven by things we notice in the present. But I do think it's very important to be explicit about what's similar and what's different. So the context in which these figures are operating is very foreign to our world today. They're navigating the transition from a very traditional society to a modern society. It's happening very quickly. In Vilna, the workers are living in a exclusively, you know, kind of working class society, very different milieu. They're dealing with issues of empire, multi-ethnic relations. The whole social and political setting in which they're operating is different. And I also need to say there are moments in Crabapple's book where she compares the political strife of the late Russian Empire to today. And those are a little bit hard for a historian of the Russian Empire to stomach in the sense that the violence of this empire, the lack of rule of law is total, right? We see the rule of law slipping away in America right now, but it's really difficult to compare what we're living through to, say, the 1905 revolution. Just the level of state repression is incredibly high, and the risks that people are taking to engage in this kind of revolutionary activity is incredibly high. It's not Instagram posts. It's not even threatening losing your job. It's threatening you're threatening to lose your head, right? If you speak out against the system. At the same time, I do think that there are compelling arguments to be made about structure and the ways that very different historical scenarios can have sort of similar structural features. And one of the things that has really struck me in teaching this material to students recently has been about the question of generation and also about the question of class. So one of the really defining features of this violence that emerges in the late Russian Empire is the fact that you can have very privileged youth feel that they have no future, that they have no economic future, they have no political future. And I think that this is something that really resonates with students today. I teach very privileged students, very incredible, intelligent students, and I see them really despairing about the world that they're graduating into. Where will they work? How will they move through the world? How can they have political impact? And these are indeed dilemmas that people faced in the late Russian Empire that I think is worth bringing out. So I think the way that I would handle this question of analogy is that it's a mistake to say that the past is the same, or even that the past can instruct us, right? Like Zionism has changed over time. Anti-Zionism has changed over time. Political possibilities have changed over time. But I think it's helpful if we think about structures and dilemmas that people face and kind of the choices that are available to any individual actor at a particular time and how the choices that historical actors have made in the past may impact the strictures or opportunities that we face today. I think that's a really productive way of thinking about past and present without simply saying, you know, it's all the same, or like the Russian Revolution is Black Lives Matter and the economic crisis of 2008 is, you know, the Bund and its working class culture.
Yeah, you begin the review by pointing out that both of the books are inspired by historical struggles, but also deeply invested in intervening into contemporary debates. And I guess I have the meta question of why to do this. And so why you think, what, if anything, the turn to history offers those who want to fight injustice to the present?
Yeah. Well, I think what history can offer is simply just is facts, right? And of understanding ways of living and ways of thinking in the past that may have been lost or forgotten. And so what I think is so valuable about both of these works is that they say, you know, no intergenerational turmoil in Jewish families is not new. Jews opposing Zionism is not new. There are rich traditions of this, and there is an entire tradition that people need to understand and learn about and tap into. At the same time, I think it's a mistake to argue that that tradition provides some kind of clear blueprint for moving forward, or that, you know, we just need to bring back the Bund and everything will be fine. I've already suggested it's not possible to bring back the Bund in the way that it existed before. I think the task rather is to, let's say, apply in a more metaphorical sense the choices and the ways of living the Bund has embraced. It's not a recipe for moving forward in the future, but I do think that simply uncovering lost traditions can be valuable in just simply knowing that they exist and also maybe informing the choices that we can make in the future.
Yeah, and I thought when you addressed this in the essay you've written about this question of who it would be who would revive this tradition of radical cross-ethnic and cross-religious solidarity. You're an American academic. You're writing from the United States. And my understanding of what you were saying was that really it is Black and brown Americans who might be the ones to carry on this tradition of a commitment to identity while also a display of solidarity. And I'm wondering if you have anything else you'd like to add about this question of what, despite these immense historical differences, this tradition or these historical commitments of Bundists to preserving personal identity and also working alongside and in solidarity with those who are different from us might offer to the sort of crisis of American multi-ethnic and multiracial coexistence in this moment.
Yeah, I think something really important to understand about the Bund is that, well, it's a bit of a paradox of the kind of move of these books, because on the one hand, the move is to say the Bund was totally dominant at one point in history, totally influential. It was a normal way of being in the world. And that's true, but it's also important to make the point that it was driven by incredibly marginal people who were so oppressed on so many levels, on religious, ethnic, political, class, right? Like all the things, who took incredible risks. As I said, they're essentially risking their life to organize a workers' union, right? This is a really different world than people like me saying, you know, Bundists are interesting and cool from the ivory tower. It's very different than, you know, even an activist who may be downwardly mobile but has middle-class parents who can help support their activism. It's really, really different. So I think we need to be careful when we think about the model of Bundism as a model of organizing in not romanticizing sort of the risks that are involved in this kind of activity, and also not fooling ourselves about where that momentum came from. Again, it didn't come from intellectuals, professors, middle-class people. It came from workers, thousands of whom died for their choices. So I think that this was a valiant cause made of very brave people. It was also many of them paid a heavy cost, and that becomes clear right throughout the books as well. And I don't think that we should lose sight of revolution is world changing and can create new ways of being, and it's also incredibly bloody and costly. And both things are true at once.
So, Faith, you have another book forthcoming, a history of the famous anti-Semitic pamphlet, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. When we talked a bit about this new project of yours before this, you described yourself as writing a sort of biography of the book, and the authorship itself being a sort of exercise in trolling or even shitposting, to use contemporary language. This image was super striking to me, and I was wondering how using these sorts of contemporary analogies or thinking self-consciously from the present can help you do history, even if you don't write it in this sort of language, but what the kind of vantage point of the present might be letting you uncover about a document that has already been kind of discussed and written about quite a bit.
Yeah. So the book is looking at the many voices and texts that go into the protocols and actually kind of dissecting how they come together and who pulls them together. And as you said, I'm able to show through that process that the people who brought them together were what they would call in the 19th century adventurers, but they're what we would call today sort of influencers or, yeah, shitsters, things like this. They are people who are using the new media structures that have emerged in the 19th century, which is the mass press, to get famous, to get rich, to rile people up. And the surprising thing that I found is that the people who created the protocols, this terrible libel, right, that has had such awful consequences for Jews across history, that they didn't even quite know what they were creating, that they were using anti-Semitism as an instrumental tool. It wasn't an ideological manifesto. It was something that they were using to defame their enemies, to get vengeance on people that they didn't like. It was in the ether, but they were pulling together these sort of negative images for their own purposes. And so I think that this gets back to what I was saying about having an eye on how, even if facts on the ground may change, structures may be similar. And there are really fascinating resonances between the media environment of the 19th century, mid-19th century, and today, where there was all this anxiety about the new voices that were coming up. Anyone could write a newspaper article and anyone could influence the public. And is this dangerous? And there were many, many people who were very eager to take advantage of that structure, right? And so I think there's a way in which, as the cliche says, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. I think as I'm writing this book, I've also been writing this book in the Trump era, in the era of new conspiracy theories, QAnon, health conspiracies, vaccine conspiracies, and thinking about the role of opportunism in creating and opportunists in creating new ideologies. And I think that one of the arguments of the book is also that this terrible ideological, what's now read as an ideological manifesto that encapsulates anti-Semitism better than any other single source, was created by opportunists who believe nothing, and who sought mostly their own power and wealth, and that perhaps the menace that these types of characters pose, the influencers, the RFK Juniors, the Trumps in building new ideological movements, perhaps that influence has been underestimated. And perhaps the danger that these kinds of characters who are not ostensibly ideological in the sense that they're not, you know, building a blueprint for some new movement, but they're just looking out for themselves. Maybe we should think about them as sort of antagonistic forces in history, not just the evil great men, as it were.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And exactly, this lack of ideology can itself build something, you know, so monstrous and so multifaceted and applicable that it can have this enduring legacy.
And it can get out of the hands of its creators, too, who sort of create a Frankenstein, right, without meaning to do so.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today, Faith.
Thank you, Hannah. It was a pleasure.
That was Faith Hillis talking to Hannah Sabo. If you'd like to read more, check out Faith's essay, Radical Jewish Traditions Then and Now, in Reader 7 of Berlin Review in print or online at blnreview.de. There you can also find all of our reviews, essays, and podcasts. Berlin Review is an independent magazine that depends on the support of its readers and listeners. If you already subscribe, thank you. If not, give it a try. For 9 euros, you get a print and online subscription with the current issue delivered to your door. If you want to watch a longer version of their conversation, check out our YouTube channel, where you'll find extended episodes and bonus content with all the guests we've had on Airlift. This episode was edited by Caitlin Roberts. I'm Tobias Haberkorn, editor of Berlin Review. Thank you, and until next time.